KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm in New York. If you were a reader of the Village Voice in the late 1970s, you may have come across a column title that may have reminded you of civilization and its discontents. The column title was Television and Its Discontents. It was the greatest and the first great TV column ever written by my guest James Walcott, who has collected some of those columns, some pieces of his film criticism from Texas Monthly, some Vanity Fair pieces, and pieces from any publication you can name almost, and his new collection, Critical Mass. Jim is back here again. Jim, it's so good to have you back on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
One of the things people have got to ask you a lot is how long it takes you, because I know really you're kind of living these pieces for a long time before you write them.
It's one of those things. It's almost like Inspector Maigret. You know, when he cracks a case, if you ever read the novels, often he's kind of in a coma. And actually the other detectives say, he's in a coma. And he's sort of sitting staring into space. And then when something happens, suddenly everything speeds up. Well, that's sort of what writing is like. I'm doing the research, whatever, but I'm calling it procrastination, but it's sort of, something is like you're not ready to go. You're not quite ready to start. And then at some point you have no choice but to start because you realize, oh, they're expecting it. So, you know, deadlines push you, but then all of a sudden it's like then it accelerates. And the good thing about that is it means that all of the things that have been sort of collecting in your head, and a lot of them are not even things you're particularly aware of, then when you have to write fast, they come out. And they're more seamless than if you're like endlessly working over a piece.
But so much of your TV writing for me was really lent itself to that thing because you had to turn the stuff over quickly anyway. Mm-hmm. And it lived in kind of an almost an evanescent state.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me like probably some of the most fun you ever had was writing the TV stuff on the weekly basis at The Voice.
Oh, it was fun. And, you know, it was pre-computers. So you were clacking away on the typewriter. And it was one of those things where I couldn't, until I got the first sentence right, I couldn't keep going. It's like I couldn't like, okay, I'll fix it later. So it'd be one of those things where you're just ripping one page after another. It's like that movie cliche where they ball it up and you see the balls of paper being tossed away. But that's what it would take. But then at a certain point, you'd hit that rhythm. But I was, I was single then. I was a night owl. So I was often staying up till 2-3 o'clock in the morning. There was no email. There was like none of this send in something as an attachment. You had to like walk it over to the building and turn it in and then go back home and crash. So there was that kind of cycle. And also, I was doing it to Village Voice, so you were part of a bigger machine because so many people were doing that in their own fields. They had to make their weekly copy.
But part of the two is that, you know, that idea of watching TV after midnight, because mm-hmm. I remember, and I'm sorry that none of these made into the book, many references to Reverend Ike in many of your columns.
Oh, yes.
Explain for our tender young listeners who might not know who Reverend Ike was.
Well, Reverend Ike was a preacher. He was super slick. He was all about materialism. But one of the things that made him so wonderful was, well, there are a couple of things. One was there was no meanness to him and there was no judgment. I don't recall him ever really talking about hell or damnation if you did this. It was like the gospel of prosperity. And like whenever somebody would mention Wall Street, he'd go, Wall Street, where the money is. And the other thing he had, though, was he had these great speeches. He was really funny. He also had great gospel groups on his show. He was like doing Washington Heights. He had a big tabernacle and he lived big. I mean,
he pulled up this church at a Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
A big Rolls Royce Continental.
Yeah. Yeah. And he would say, you know, don't be blocking my Rolls Royce when I got someplace to go, you know? And he also, they sold things on the show, like if you paid a $10 pledge, you would get things. And one of the things was, it was a blessing shower cap. And it was a shower cap that had the imprint of a hand. So if you put the shower cap on, you were to pretend that Reverend Ike was blessing your head. And I just loved all that because that was around the same time And this was a piece I never finished and never got into the book, but I was supposed to do a piece for The New Yorker about the PTL Club. And I went down there and saw Jim Baker and Tammy Faye. I saw their studios. I saw them do productions. The thing was, I could not get any access to them because they were like, a New York writer? No, we're not going to. You're going to do something. Even though The New Yorker did not want me to do any mockery.
Which, talk about hamstringing me.
Put me in handcuffs already. Don't make any jokes. Because, you know, you're talking about Tammy Faye Baker, who would, like, have a meltdown. Like
every show.
Every show, and the mascara would run.
Cascading down her face.
Yeah. And she had not become sort of the gay icon she became later.
But there's that kind of culture that you could write about that was sort of unite the people who knew about it and the people who didn't would seek mm-hmm. it out. There wasn't a kind of monolithic pop culture which exists now. Basically, you know, if you turn TV on a local station on after midnight, it's all infomercials.
Right.
Although, in effect, Reverend Ike was kind of an infomercial.
Yeah.
But
there
was an enormous entertainment aspect to it. And one of the things I sort of love about spending time with you and reading you is you have an enormous affinity for people who give and receive pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
You got a terrific piece in the collection. Critical Mass, by the way, is the name of the collection, on SCTV. And if you read that now, it'd be...
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
This is about they would do an annual Christmas show, and this was the show in which Johnny LaRue had a breakdown. They forced him to go out and interview people on the street during a blizzard.
Street beat.
And...
He hated to do, by the way, that he would start to whine whenever he was forced to do street beat, which is always kind of a punishment.
Please, Mr. Kevin, don't make me do street beat. And then he gets drunk and he's like, I want to apologize to everyone I know, everyone who's ever known me. So this is a paragraph about that particular Christmas special. Beautiful is not a word often applied to comedy, but SCTV's December 18th Christmas special was such a seamless wave of wit and dream logic and affection that a lesser word won't serve. As a tightly wrapped Catholic spinster checked passes at the door, the camera poked its head into the SCTV staff Christmas party, where familiar faces were freshening their tonsils and casting wayward glances at the leggy numbers draping themselves at the fringes. Bobby Bittman sauntered through, the clink of his medallions announcing his presence like a bell ribboned around a kitten's throat. Edith Prickly, copping a snort at the bar, chortingly teased the butch bartender. What are you doing here tonight? Your Nautilus equipment breakdown? While Lola Heatherton and Dr. Tongue rehearsed the lyrics to a new 3D musical. The party was a daisy chain of in-jokes, and the jokes blossomed in rich abundance as the show rolled on.
You were one of the early appreciators of SCTV just because of that blossoming insularity that demanded that you watch from week to week. But you also really know that, again, the pleasure the performers got out of acting out these roles, that was really evident to you. And that was a difference in those days between SCTV and Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it's definitely a difference. And one of the things, I mean, SNL now does so many pre-taped bits. But they're all kind of gimmick bits. They're kind of like bits that have like one particular thing they're getting across. So you don't get that sense of like, SCTV was often like a combination of like a Robert Altman movie and a Mad Magazine comic. There was this sort of teeming thing of parodies and people moving through. You know, the irony is when the Village Voice decided more or less that they had had enough of me. And I went in for a meeting with the editor. And, you know, at that point, it was really time for me to go. One of the things they brought up was like, you know, they're writing too much about SCTV.
My guest is James Walcott. His new collection of reviews and essays is Critical Mass. It's The Treatment. His career went from The Village Voice to New York Magazine to Vanity Fair to The New Yorker and back to Vanity Fair, where you've been basically since 1984, right?
Yeah, except for
The New Yorker.
Except for The New Yorker. But I was there. I came in before Tina Brown. During that kind of weird...
when it was basically it was sort of like a Christie's catalog under Leo.
Sort of, what a strange time. But also it was, you know, people now take Vanity Fair's success for granted. But at the time when I joined, people were telling me...
It was a death watch.
Yeah, they were advising me not to do it. They were saying they're going to get rid of Leo and close the magazine. I would hear rumors, people would say, well, you know, I hear the magazine's not taking any advertising after the October issue. You know, some of these rumors were sort of well-based. So,
because they did get rid of them.
Yeah, and even after Tina Brown came in, there was about a year and a half in which it was still touch and go because the magazine began getting more attention, but it also, the advertising did not pick up. Advertisers always lag. They're waiting for other advertisers to jump in the pool.
Nobody wants to be first.
Yeah, and so they're waiting, and eventually it happened, but no, but I have been there ever since and seen the rise and fall and rise again of the Roman Empire. You know,
but when Tina came in, too, that tattler she ran was something you used to even write about in mm-hmm. other places. So it was almost like you guys were simpatico before you even met.
Yeah, well, we had sort of the same energy. I mean, she's much more keyed up than I am. The thing is, one of the things I learned very early on was you cannot tell her a long story at an editorial meeting, you know, because she begins to sort of tremble in her seat. Or if the meeting's gone on too long, you got to make it really sharp, really pitch it. But the good thing about Vanity Fair in the early days was, since nothing was really working, they were willing to try anything. But for example, early on, and he just started out, Madonna, people started talking about Madonna. And I said, you know, and they said, okay, we've got to do something on Madonna. So, they flew me out to Chicago the next day, got the tickets. I see Madonna. I come back and I have to write it in, 2 days. And the thing was, I enjoyed that kind of thing. But at that time, because no one quite knew what was going to work, there wasn't a formula, that meant that things were much more improvisational.
Well, the magazine felt like that, though, in that sort of sense that the British magazine that Tina Brown ran, Tatler, kind of felt like that, too. Mm-hmm. It felt like it was kind of in that case, a conscious rebuke to what was going on in British periodicals. Vanity Fair kind of became an unconscious rebuke to what was going on to American magazines. Mm-hmm. But that sort of sense of being contrary to the pop culture stream is something that's kind of embedded in you as a thinker anyway. Mm-hmm. So it was a perfect place for you in that respect, wasn't it?
Well, it was in large part because, you know, when I was first asked to join Vanity Fair, it was Richard Locke, who had been, you know, he was a books guy. He was a literary editor. And when he interviewed me, he already had 3 or 4 literary people. And I said, I don't really see what I'm doing. And at one point he said, you know, I don't see this as a magazine. I see this as an ongoing cultural enterprise. And I was like, oh, okay, beam me up, Scotty. you know, but I thought, I don't know what's going on. So that's why I didn't sign on in. With Tina, she jumbled up, you know, and Graydon does that as well, jumbled up the high-low thing.
You mean Graydon?
Yeah, because Tina's whole thing was you got to give socialites, you got to give that glammy part of the world, but you also have to do the thing that everyone's buzzing about, you know, on a street level or at a party level. And you've got to mix it up. And of course, what happened was the early days of Vanity Fair, they were going too much for more pristine, traditional, museum, institutional arts coverage. And so eventually they moved away from it. But there was a huge amount of tension, you know, all the way along in the early days. And one of the things that happened to Vanity Fair was, and it was before I got there, they were massacred by the print press. You know, the fact is, the print press is one of its own worst enemies. I mean, it's one of the worst cultures in the world. It's one of the few places where people really root for other people to fail, even in their field, even though it means people are going to be unemployed. The hatred of Vanity Fair, before it started because of the ad campaign, it was an Annie Leibovitz ad campaign, people really wanted it to fail. Never mind that it was this is going to be a place where writers are not going to be showcased. They're going to be paid well. I mean, now it's if you're lucky, I was like, well, we might, you know, you might get 3 cents a word if you do something online. You know, they were going to pay people well. But when the first issue came out, it got massacred. And it was, the magazine was reeling. I mean, everybody involved. The thing is, it hasn't gotten worse because the ranks have thinned out. But in many ways, it's still there. It is that kind of, there's rooting for failure, which people in the dance world don't root for other companies to fail. It just doesn't happen.
My guest who's talking about how Santayana's philosophy applies to the magazine world is James Walcott. His newest collection of terrific essays is Critical Mass. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it.
Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is Jim Walcott, who's back again. He was last here for his collection, his memoir, Lucking Out. His newest book is a collection of essays and reviews called Critical Mass. You start the book off, you kind of bookend it. You start with Norman Mailer. Mm-hmm. You're going to bring us back to that. Mm-hmm. But in that piece, though, on Mailer in the beginning of the book, it goes back to what that world was like when there wasn't even a videotape machine.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to sort of basically let people know, these are my notes about the proceedings, watching this thing unfold on a Dick Cavett show.
It's on YouTube. People, everybody can see it.
Janet Flanner, Norman Mailer, and Gore Vidal in the mm-hmm. conversation being sort of emceed by Dick Cavett. Mm-hmm. Which is, but it gets away from him in the way that talk shows don't ever get away from the host anymore.
Yeah. And as the years went on and I learned more about what happened behind the scenes of the show, I'm still sympathetic to Mailer and some of his outbursts. I mean, but I'm also much more sympathetic to Gore Vidal. And I got to know Vidal slightly before his death. But one of the things I'm just amazed by with Vidal is learning that before this Dick Cavett show, one of the things you learn is that not only did Mailer come out combatively, he headbutted Vidal in the green room before the show. And to me, what a lesson in courage and nerve that Vidal then went on the show, because most people would be like, I got headbutted in the green room. I'm not going out on the air. Who knows what he might do? And Vidal goes out there like nothing had happened. He totally retains his composure. He's totally unruffled. You know, nothing like that would ever happen now. If anything slightly untoward, first of all, imagine any guest talking to the host the way that Mailer talked to Cavett. I mean, it would not happen. First of all, the booing would start immediately. If anybody said anything to Letterman, you know, Letterman would twist sideways in his chair and he'd look over the guest's shoulder and basically it would be over.
Well, even Carson would have done. The reason I brought up mm-hmm. talk shows too is because you've got a terrific section in the book that deals with Letterman and Leno mm-hmm. and Carson. And one of the things that also runs through the book too is your interest in people who have to have control. I mean, with Brian De Palma or, mm-hmm. or Mailer, the sense of people with this kind of pincers and tong concentration is something that attracts you as a writer too, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the thing is, one of the things you learn is that the power of it, but also the limits of it. You know, in terms of Mailer didn't listen to people he should have listened to, particularly later. And there are huge flaws with the big novels that he could have easily fixed if he had listened to people. You know, it's funny how you get about people, because, like, I'm reading all these, like, terrible, horrible bombshells about, you know, Johnny Carson and what an awful person.
Oh, his former lawyer has a book to tell.
Yeah, his former lawyer.
Have you read that book yet?
No, but I've seen the highlights. And well, you know, Carson joked about it before
Bombastic
he retired.
Bushing.
Yeah, and before he retired, he said, you know, my staff is rushing to copyright the words cold and aloof, you know. And he used to make jokes about how, you know, I'm celebrating the 4th of July in my traditional way, throwing steaks up against the electric fence, you know, to grill them. But the funny thing is, like, with Carson, it's like whatever terrible thing I read about him, I sort of, like, forgive it. It's like I don't care because I go by what was on the show, whereas other hosts, and I don't want to mention their names, but they'll say, oh, he is just the greatest guy. He's just a great guy. And that's how he is on here. He's a great guy. And I'm like, yeah, and I can't watch them. Because everything is like, wow, it's great. Oh, that's awesome. Oh, that's fabulous. And I like the ones who are like, have this undercurrent of like, you don't quite know where they're going to turn. And with Carson could suddenly turn on the chill. And as you as a viewer were aware of it, and often the guest wasn't, you know, but if you were a student of Carson, you're like, ooh, yeah.
It's The Treatment. My guest, I'm mm-hmm. thrilled to have him back, is James Walcott. His great new collection of essays from The New Yorker and Vanity Fair and New Republic and many other places mm-hmm. is called Critical Mass. For example, again, go back to Brian De Palma. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you included the film section because people have talked to you, of course, about mm-hmm. your early appreciation of Patti Smith,
mm-hmm.
who, again, was somebody who got pleasure from what she was doing, and you connected to that
mm-hmm.
in that way that the pleasure givers.
Yeah.
I almost thought you should call the book that because it feels so much about
doesn't
that.
Doesn't it sound like the kind of movie with like Pamela Tiffin?
Suzanne Plachette.
Suzanne Plachette. The pleasure givers. There they
directed
are.
Directed by E.W. Swackhammer.
They went to Rome on a... Three of them in one room. The pleasure givers.
But there is so much fun, and you had so much mm-hmm. fun in writing the film reviews. And you even mentioned in your introduction that kind of popping along since you got writing the reviews. And it was also a really terrific period to write the reviews, that period in the 80s when you didn't know what was going to happen from film to film.
I don't know if it would be fun now to write about films, not only because the films are often so grim and so overbearing, but because there's so many people doing it, it's kind of a cacophony no matter how you try to like carve out your little area, your little space. I mean,
and now it seems to be, because I think for you, I hate to use the word contrarian because it sounds like a fixed position, but I think so much now what you're talking about, the kind of stuff we see online is kind of this willfully contrarian, just contradictory to be contradictory rather than being an arrived at aesthetic.
Yeah, and there's a lot of like hyperbole and going both ways. Such and Such is the worst movie ever made. Well, it can't be the worst movie ever made because there's like clearly movies much worse that we're not thinking of. Or people like in January, forget it. Your Oscar winner next year is Such and Such. And there's just a lot of that. It's a lot of positioning. And it's gotten worse because of all the film bloggers and all who go to all these different festivals. And so they're all like, they come out and they're immediately like angling themselves in terms of, well, what is the big movie coming out of Toronto this year? What is the big movie out of this? You know, I sort of nostalgic for like when Manny Farber would go to movies and he would just do, you know, two paragraphs on a movie. He would just like pop into the theater and write about it. And there wasn't a sense of like, I got to treat every movie as some big rollout. And even now, I have to say in television criticism, I myself am exhausted with the recappers. You know, the people who write a 3,000-word analysis of American Horror Story Coven. And it's just sort of like wearing out the you know, and a lot of it's ingenious and everything, but it really kind of just wears out. Even if you're showing you're enthusiastic about.
That's funny because you mentioned that. And one of the things that you work very hard to do, even if you're attending an event that probably nobody else is going to get a chance to see because they weren't there that night, you go out of your way to not summarize what the plot or to retell the story. And that's something that came to you pretty early on. And again, you were kind of fighting a tradition of that when you started writing that idea of sort of telling people what they have seen, which is what you're talking about in these exhaustive summaries of these TV shows. They just basically write the plot out as if somehow you couldn't DVR the show yourself or find it online.
Yeah, they write it out and then they put in like little jokes. They do like a lot of little jokes and asides. And, you know, one of the things that I have to say is I'm really puzzled by, and I've seen it with like, when I came up, there was this thing of like people would say, oh God, don't do a movie like it's a book report. Because so many people would do it. They would do a movie as if it weren't really a movie and something you were watching, but like the theme, you know, how the theme is brought out. And I've seen student papers and people have told me, even film students, supposedly the great visual generation, they still write in that kind of way of like they're doing a book report. And like they accept the theme or they didn't really buy the theme of the movie. And I thought, you know, where was, I remember the whole period where it was going to be like, it was going to be an immersive experience and the erotics of cinema and we're going to drown it. It's like, no, everybody is as boringly liberal humanistic as they ever were.
That's exactly what it is. You basically, as a reader, as a viewer, as an audience member, you want to be lost in something. And what's so much fun about reading is even the awful experience of the Salma Gundy conference. is you are completely lost in the moment.
Yeah.
And you want to impart that to you. And I've always wondered where that came from for you.
I don't know. I think I was always sort of interested in theater as like human theater, like the way people are in real life, the way people behave. I mean, for example, when I went to see the Salma Gundy conference, which was something like Wither Civilization. It was something like that, like the culture of the West. With the major intellects of the time, it was like Susan Sontag was there, Leslie Fiedler, Cynthia Ozick. And I actually paid less attention to what they were, you know, like their arguments were, because a lot of them were the traditional arguments. But like I was fascinated, like the interplay and also the sense of like the hierarchy, who respected whom and who kind of dismissed people. Like there was like a great moment where Cynthia Ozick said, because Cynthia Ozick was taking the super highbrow position. She said, well, you know, in my neighborhood growing up and even now, I am really looked down upon. I am disparaged. I'm ostracized because I go to the library and I read books. And Leslie Fiedler said something like, are you sure that's the reason? I laughed at, but nobody else laughed at. And then there was a great discussion between Dwight MacDonald and Stanley Kaufman. And every time Stanley Kaufman talked about the wonders of culture, and Dwight MacDonald would go, oh, no, that just sounds awful. And Dwight MacDonald said at one point, he said, you know, we'd really all be doing ourselves a break if, like, we said, okay, no more new theater, no more new books for a year. Let's all catch up. Let's all catch up on things. And what was interesting was Dwight MacDonald used to be a major intellectual force, but now they, he was older, they were treating him like the doddering uncle that they had to indulge. So I'm always interested in, like, the human interplay, how people conduct themselves, how the hierarchy sort of emerges. And this is why, for example, if I go to a party, a cocktail party, I'm that's the sort of thing I'm interested in. I'll mention other people, certain dynamics, and I'll go, I don't know, what? When was that? I must have been getting the canapes or something like
that. But it's that sense of kind of, your powers of observation come mm-hmm. from loving observing and just loving that sense of being transported by anything you're watching or attending. Mm-hmm. And it's a thing that I think makes you such a singular thinker on culture.
Oh well, thanks. You know, part of it is I don't think, even though people think I'm cynical because I've
written
cynical things.
You can't read this book and not think and think that.
Yeah, because I'm always, the thing is, I'm always interested. A cynical person is someone who goes, basically, there's no point in looking at this because I don't, you know, it's already, I'm bored and I've already seen this kind of thing. Whereas I'm always interested, like, well, what is so-and-so really up to? When I go to a book panel, I'm not interested in, like, what they're going to say about literature, because it's all going to be a lot, you know, lies. They're all going to, like, tell these stories about how, you know, each day when I write, I think of those writers who came before. I'm like, no, you don't. You don't think about the writers who came before. But what I'm interested in is what goes over with an audience and what doesn't go over. And so I like a certain showmanship in people. And one of the things I really miss in writing now, and is such different from the 60s and 70s, is writers had a much more showman quality than Mailer did, Vidal, Buckley, Sontag in a different way, but she definitely did. Now, these panels, everyone is just so, it's almost like the Charlie Rose syndrome, whereas they go on, you know, with Charlie, nobody wants to kind of like be exuberant or, you know, stylized. They're all talking in really earnest ways. And I think audiences miss that. I think their audiences are bored without knowing that they're, you know, bored with this.
Well, that sort of sense of theater that really made the talk shows and, mm-hmm. and made literature, and that sort of sense of being presentational. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know why anybody can call you cynical unless you go back to, I think it was Lawrence who called, inside the heart of every cynic beats the heart of a romantic. Every true mm-hmm. cynic. And that, if they're going to define you as that, it's because you want to be moved by something in that Byronic sense. You want to be romanced by something.
Yeah, I'm cynical only in the sense of, like, I'm suspicious of people's motives when they pretend to be I'm sort of like, okay, this is what you say you're up to, but what are you really up to? It's sort of like, what are you really trying to get across with this? That's the sort of thing that fascinates me. One of the reasons I'm so bored with theater now is theater can be so mundane. I mean, I go to the theater and I look at people on stage and I'm going, you're worse dressed than I am. You know, it's like, I don't want to watch these people in, like, flannel tops come in the stage, and then they're all like, they've all like just come out of rehab, you know, or there's some, like, they've got some, like, poignant, paralyzing problem in their past that they're going to go over. I'm like, wait, come on, where's the, you know, like, where's the Tennessee Williams exuberance, and, you know?
And on that note, we're out of time. It's always so good to have you here. Jim, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me back.
My pleasure. My guest is James Walcott. His newest collection of essays and reviews is Critical Mass. Our show is recorded at Argo Studios by Paul Ruess. It's mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. This is The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.